Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jessica Yellen in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Nearly 20% of American workers today are bound by a non-compete agreement. That's one in five of us. What was once a necessary precaution to keep top executives from bringing insider intel to a rival has now spilled over into the contracts of sandwich makers, hairstylists, even Amazon warehouse workers. This hour, On Point, non-compete agreements and the handcuffing of employees. You can join us on air or online. Have you been asked to sign a non-compete? Did you? Did you even know you were signing it? Did it come back to bite you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Oakland, California, is Connor Doherty, technology correspondent for The New York Times. His recent story is How Non-Compete Clauses Keep Workers Locked In. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Welcome, Connor.
Hi. How are you?
Thanks for being with us. So let's start by asking you to explain what is a non-compete.
So a non-compete is just a thing in a contract that says for some period of time, usually a year or two and some radius, sometimes a couple hundred miles of your workplace or sometimes the whole country, you can't go work for a competitor within that time and within that radius. And that's pretty much what it is.
What's the purpose?
It's to keep people, well, that kind of depends on who you
are. The legitimate purpose, originally.
Right. Some people say it's wage suppression to keep people from getting a competing offer. Other people would say that it protects intellectual property. Obviously, you know, it's sort of a squishy gray area depending on how you view these things, right?
What are some of the jobs in which non-competes are now required, jobs we might not expect?
I think that there is probably every job description now, it seems like, has had a non-compete. I mean, it would be easier. I cannot think of one.
Can you come up with some of the more bizarre examples? Tell us.
Fast food, for one. I mean, the archetypal, like, low-wage job is fast food. The no skill, whatever, right? People are being asked to sign non-competes in fast food. There's a guy that I talked to for my story who shovels dirt for $10 an hour. He was asked to sign a non-compete. And then obviously all the way up to high-up executives where you would expect this to happen. So everyone, everywhere. I mean, it's every industry, every description. Obviously, it varies from company to company, but you could find them anywhere almost.
What's the practical effect of enforcing a non-compete against, say, a fast food worker or an Amazon warehouse worker or a yoga instructor?
It's hard. In cases like that, it seems like it's something along the lines of intimidation, meaning that I don't get the sense that those are enforced and those workers are really sued all that often. But it's a way to kind of remind them, you know, you can't leave to go get a better offer. You can't shop around for a better wage. It's hard to imagine in the case of fast food what skills being protected, what kind of proprietary information is being protected.
In your story, you wrote about someone named Keith Bollinger, who's a factory manager. He had some skills, but he wasn't a senior executive, and he was sued because of a non-compete. Would you tell us what happened to him? How did it hurt his life?
Keith is one of those people who had just enough to lose that he could be ruined by this. A fast food worker, they might not have anything. A senior executive, they might have plenty of money to have a lawyer hash it out for them. Keith is a middle-class American. He makes $75,000, or he was making $70,000. He's a factory manager, so what he does is he basically they treat fabric with chemicals, and he kind of managed that process. He was not a chemist to make the chemicals, but he kind of helped manage the process that they were applied on the thing. So after the recession, textile industry got hit very hard, and his salary went down. And, of course, for those years, those dark years, he was just happy to have a job. But then the recovery happened, and a rival factory offered him $75,000 after his salary had fallen down, and he took it. He had signed a non-compete agreement just a couple years earlier. When he signed it, he felt like he basically had to sign it to keep his job, you know, meaning he signed it, you know, almost two decades after having had this job. He got sued. The first round of court, he won. They appealed, and in the second round of court, he lost. This is a long odyssey that I'm shrinking, but, you know, he spent $50,000 of his own and borrowed money to pay a lawyer. It was 3.5 years of legal fighting. And finally, what happened with him and other defendants, which was the company he went to, ended up having to pay $200,000 to the original company to settle this case.
And then he ended up without a job.
He got a job somewhere else in the meantime, but he spent a lot of time in unemployment and obviously spent all this money defending himself in court. And it was absolutely devastating for his family because, you know, like I said, he's one of those people who, you know, he's a middle-class guy. He's got a house. He's got some things. He's got some savings. But he doesn't have enough to go hiring lawyers for $50,000, $100,000.
We have some listeners who've written in on our website. One says, the use of these things to control any worker is a sign of how far the nation has fallen. It really does sometimes seem as if it's a constant struggle between labor and capital. Capital is winning. And Rebecca Hatcher on Facebook says, businesses do not force non-compete agreements on lesser skilled positions in order to compensate for education and training. They do this for the sole purpose of providing less pay to people in these positions. And Connor, I wonder if you've seen that in effect. Does it keep people from negotiating for higher wages because they can't be poached by the competitor down the street?
Well, in Keith's case, it obviously did. And in many other cases, it does. It certainly does that in a lot of cases. I mean, there are certain people. Let's be realistic. There are certain people who are like high-flying engineers who are very cognizant of their employment contract, and they walk into a negotiation. They see this non-compete. They negotiate their contract, right? But most people aren't like that. Most people don't have the absolute the leverage in the first place, and even if they did, aren't reading their contracts super closely. I mean,
do you find that? Do you find that some of the people you interviewed signed a non-compete without realizing it?
Yes. I mean, one guy, a guy I talked to who made $10 an hour shoveling dirt, he was 18 years old and had a kid, when he was 17 years old. He was like, what am I going to do? Negotiate over it? You know, he didn't even know what it was until he got sued over it.
Let me pause you there for just a moment because I'd like to bring in a lawyer. We're talking with Russell Beck, is joining us now. He's a partner at the Boston law firm Beck, Reed & Ryden, where he specializes in non-compete and trade secret agreements. He's also the author of the book Negotiating, Drafting, and Enforcing Non-Competition Agreements and Related Restrictive Covenants. Welcome, Russell.
Hi, Jessica. Thanks for having me.
So what is, in the most honorable, noble context, the purpose of a good non-compete?
So a good non-compete is really designed to protect a company's information and its customer relationships. That's it. That's what it should be used for.
Give us an example of the perfect candidate for a non-compete.
Imagine someone who heads up the marketing department for Pepsi, and they know exactly what their plans are for the next year about how they're going to deal with Coca-Cola and how they're going to get market share from Coca-Cola. You can't let them go over to Coke and then do Coke's marketing plan.
Now, you've seen some abuses of non-competes. I'll ask you in a moment to tell us an example of that, but I'd like to know first, is it legal to enforce these things against people who've been fired?
It is. It depends on the state. State law varies. Every state has its own laws on this issue. But as a general matter, in most states, yes, it is enforceable. The courts will take it into account, but they will enforce it if there's a need.
What's the possible logic for that? You've booted this person out of your company. They need to find other work. They have to rely on their own skills. You're handcuffing humans from getting good-paying jobs.
Right. And actually, the doctrine in Pennsylvania is called the worthless employee doctrine. And the notion is if they're not good enough to work for you, then you don't need an agreement to stop them from working for somebody else. The flip side to that is sometimes a company has financial constraints and they can't continue to keep all these employees on, and so they have to let people go. If you allow somebody who really can cause harm to the company to go to a competitor and work for the competitor, that actually can exacerbate the already difficult financial circumstances of the company.
So that person's expected to move somewhere very far away to get a job?
Or work in a job that isn't competitive with what they were doing beforehand. These agreements are supposed to be very narrowly drafted. The problem is that oftentimes they're not.
And if they're not narrowly drafted, are they challengeable in court? Do they succeed when you challenge them in court often?
So if they are too broadly drafted, then it depends on the state, again, that you're in. In some states, the court's actually allowed to fix them. And in other states, the court has to throw them out.
Connor, have you seen examples of people who have had to live on disability because they had a non-compete, they want to work, but they're not allowed to get a job?
Not disability, but certainly unemployment. I had a guy who left a job, got another job, the better paying job. The old employer wrote a letter saying, he is not allowed to take that job. The company basically told him, look, you're a lower level salesman. We're not going to get in a legal fight for you. They were pretty frank with him about it. He had to leave his job and he got unemployment. So he was on unemployment for several months. And then in the meantime, when the unemployment ran out, just to get some money in the door, he went and became a landscaper. Now, this was an Air Force veteran and college graduate who was doing sales and marketing. And he had to go basically mow lawns for $15 an hour, not because he was down on his luck, but because he was basically prohibited from working. And he wasn't going to move. He's a guy with like two kids or something.
Russell, quickly, would a guy like that have a claim in court or not necessarily?
No, he doesn't have a claim. He just is out of luck.
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about how nearly one in five American workers, from the front office to the counters at some fast food restaurants, are legally bound by non-compete agreements. You can join the conversation. Did you have trouble finding a new job because you were shackled by a non-compete? Did you sign one because you felt you had no choice? We're talking with Connor Doherty, technology correspondent for The New York Times. He wrote the recent story, How Non-Compete Clauses Keep Workers Locked In. And in studio is Russell Beck, a partner at the Boston law firm Beck, Reed, Ryden, where he specializes in non-compete and trade secret agreements. Russell, I'd love for you to tell us a few of your more eye-popping stories about how non-competes have gone wrong.
Absolutely. And to qualify it, of course, there are lots of times when they make sense to enforce. On the other hand, there are a lot of times when they don't. One case that I had a few years back involved a pizza maker who literally came over to the United States from Italy and was working for a company. They had him sign a non-compete. And when they wanted him out of the company, they asked him to leave and they tried to enforce the restriction against him. It was going to prevent him from working anywhere in the state making pizza. He couldn't really afford to litigate and defend against something like that. So what happens with those kinds of cases is you try to negotiate out a resolution.
Did they give him one?
They did. They allowed him to work making pizza somewhere outside of a 3-mile radius of where they were located.
Well done.
And, thank you.
And have you seen instances where it hasn't worked out?
I have seen instances in which it hasn't worked out. A woman out of state who was working basically just making cold calls. And the company came after her 3 years after she had left and tried to enforce a non-compete that was, I believe it was 5 years. And she was basically told she can't do it, couldn't fight it again. It kind of died out, but she restrained herself from continuing to compete.
That's astonishing.
Yeah.
Okay, let's take some calls. Darcy is calling in from Glastonbury, Connecticut. Hi, Darcy. What's on your mind?
Hi, Jessica. So my question, I'm a small business owner, and I've sort of been the victim of not having a non-compete. I run a children's entertainment business, and I've, you know, brought in staff over the past 14 years and taught them how to be face painters and balloon twisters, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, unfortunately, not every employee is a right fit. And yes, I've let people go, and I'm not worried about those people. It's the people that have chosen to leave on their own with all of, you know, my, what I consider my trade secrets. I taught them. They were not in this field when I hired them. And they have not only gone to work for other companies, which one would expect, they have gone and started their own companies and taken all of that information that I trained them with. And a lot of my, you know, peers in the field have given me feedback, well, you need to make them sign a non-compete. And as a small business owner, I'm not sure how enforceable that non-compete would be. What sort of recourse would I really have to prevent this from happening again? Because now I have two ex-employees who are literally right in my backyard who are now my day-to-day competitors.
Darcy, thank you for the call. Russell, that is one of the rationale for these non-competes. You take an unskilled worker, you train them, you hope that they apply those skills to your business. And so it's meant to sort of ensure that they do.
And that's a risk that companies take. So training, separate from unique knowledge that you can only learn at that company, is not protectable in most states. In some states it is, but in most states you can't protect just training that you could have learned anywhere.
Is that not the purpose of making them sign a non-compete, so that you're protecting that education?
Well, the education, if it's unique to your company, yes. If it's outside of what they, if it's something that they could learn anywhere, then that's not a legitimate purpose.
Interesting. Scott is calling in from Tampa, Florida. Hi, Scott. What's on your mind?
Hi, Jessica. I do financial consulting, and I have over 20 years experience, and I was with a CFO consulting firm for about 2.5 years. And as the company grew, it went from a pretty small company to, a bit, you know, maybe a couple, three times the size. Once it grew, they asked us to sign a non-compete. And I ended up leaving there and starting my own firm, or at least thinking about starting my own firm. It actually encouraged me to kind of step back and think about what I wanted to do. So the day after your guest's article came out, I turned in my resignation, and I'm going to start my own firm.
Because of that article. Connor, did you hear that?
Yes. Wow, that's awesome.
You had an effect. All right. Thank you for the call, Scott. Ken now is on the line. He's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Ken, what's on your mind?
Hi, Jessica. Hi, Russell. I'm calling because I am a PhD and highly educated in my field and have been offered the opportunity to live the dream to get the job of my lifetime. And I have a non-compete with my employer, which stands in the way. And this is a frustrating and difficult to understand stance. It's hard to reason why the world is a better place by keeping people who are perhaps less effective in one spot from moving to the spot where they would be more effective and would bring more benefit to the world. And in addition, it's hard to understand how you are free to move when you have such specialized information from prior life that you are effectively pigeonholed in an industry and can no longer transfer out of the industry because of the non-competes.
Connor, have you spoken with employers who are sensitive to these kinds of problems?
Yes, but I think he, I forget the caller's name, but he makes some great points. And I think that we can get lost. The point he made is, how does this make the world a better place? And I think that that's the real question. I mean, I can talk to Russell, but I've talked to Russell before, back and forth about, oh, is this legal, is that legal? Let's just ask this much bigger question, which is, what if you just, there's a million reasons you want to leave your job. I don't know, what if you don't like the people you work with? That happens. What if you don't, you just don't, the place is kind of far from your house? What if you're just kind of bored with the work? Like, when you're in that situation, you should leave so that you feel more ambitious, more excited. You know, your talents are being used in a much more productive way when you do that. And if you're stuck in this job that just isn't working out for you, that I just don't see how the world is better off. Now, I don't know if you're going to get into this later, but there's a lot of data and a lot of study to show that one of the reasons the Silicon Valley has been so successful is specifically because they're not allowed to enforce non-competes, which is funny because that's the place where you would think all this specialized knowledge would be, and it is. But in addition to allowing people to find, you know, better, you know, fits for themselves personally, you just kind of increase the velocity of innovation. You know, once everyone knows a secret within 4 or 5 years, you got to start coming up with new secrets. And it really pushes us to, it pushes us as a society to come up with more stuff more quickly, because you know, you can't hold on to it for that long, because it is true. It will, your secrets will sort of just get out there. And there's a big argument to be made that what's good for the economy is often not good for individual companies.
We're actually going to talk about that right now, because joining us from Princeton, New Jersey is Alan Krueger, professor of economics at Princeton University. He's also a former chairman of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors, where he was a member of the Obama cabinet from 2011 to 2013. He also wrote a story this month for the Milken Institute Review titled The Rigged Labor Market. Welcome, Professor Krueger.
Hi, Jessica. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. You talk about the rigged economy. What does that mean?
Well, I think non-competes are an example of how the labor market is increasingly becoming rigged against workers. We're not seeing free competition, perfect competition, the way we think an economy should operate. And I think that non-competes are just part of the picture. There are other things that also preclude perfect competition from taking place over labor to the detriment of workers.
Would you give us some examples? I've read mandatory arbitration clauses, non-solicitation. Explain some of these factors, if you would.
Well, one area that I'm particularly concerned about is implicit or sometimes explicit collusion on the part of employers to not raid employees away from other competitors, to conspire to keep wages low. This is something remarkably that Adam Smith warned about well over 200 years ago. And there are many examples, including in Silicon Valley, where companies such as Apple and Google and others agreed not to hire employees away from each other to restrain competition. And this has been affecting not only workers with advanced degrees, but also professions like nurses, where in Detroit and 5 other cities, there have been court cases alleging and often finding that the hospitals colluded to prevent competition over nurses, to coordinate pay, keep pay lower than the market would generate. And all of that is to the detriment of workers.
But, Professor, surely the senior executives at these companies know it's illegal to conspire with other companies to not poach their workers. They're doing it anyway. They don't think they'll get caught?
Well, it's rare that there's enforcement actions. Towards the end of the Obama administration, the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission issued guidelines for human resource personnel. I think more enforcement actions would help to deter this type of behavior. But many of the executives act as if there's very little enforcement or they're not aware of the restrictions that they face.
I want to take a moment to listen to President Obama, who actually addressed some of these issues in his weekly address back on December 17th last year. Then he said, non-compete agreements do significant harm to American workers.
This year, we also addressed 2 other problems that keep workers and wages down. The overuse of non-compete agreements that hurt workers in the job market, and the unfair practices of companies that collude to set wages below the market rate.
So it was a concern of President Obama's. We'll see if that remains a priority going forward. But I'd like you to address, Professor Krueger, if you would, the larger effects of these policies, because it doesn't just hurt the workers. You've done research to show that non-competes make states have 10% lower wages, where states that enforce non-competes have wages that are 10% lower than states that restrict their use. So it's bad for us all.
That's not my work, but that's work that I cited that was done by the Treasury Department. And it does appear to be the case that states which have restricted the use of non-competes find that earnings grow more quickly over time for workers, which would make sense if those workers are able to seek better opportunities when they arise.
So it diminishes entrepreneurship as well?
That's very likely the case. If the way the non-compete agreement is structured prohibits workers from starting up new companies or from bringing their energy to new companies.
Let's go to the phone lines. Ava is calling in from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Hi, Ava. What's on your mind?
Hi. I have a couple of comments. My livelihood is directly impacted and affected based on what I do, which is I assist people to find other jobs as talent acquisition or executive search. So I run up against these things all the time. And to your point, Jessica, you had mentioned earlier in the program, handcuffing people from getting better or different jobs is exactly what goes on. But lately, the term poach by companies is out there. And that's specifically why my firm is often retained. So that whole thing goes away because you're not poaching from each other, but rather an objective person who is then going to partner with that employee to take them somewhere else. But one of my favorite comments over the years, or quotes, when I'm dealing with a scared candidate, when it comes down to a non-compete, are we in the former Soviet Union with those types of tactics, or are we in a free society known as America that these things are taking place? And so I do think often they are enforced for the wrong reason. My father was actually a graduate of BU Law School and practiced for many years in Massachusetts. But he used to say, although not specifically in employment law, that a lot of times it's perception that, you know, really, is a company going to expend all that money for a lawsuit?
Right. This is what Connor was saying earlier, that it's largely intimidation. In some contexts, it's meant to just deter you from finding another job. Connor, I'm curious. Some states do have laws limiting when non-competes can be used or even barring them altogether. Is that a growing trend in the country?
It's a lot of states want to, it is a growing trend that a lot of states want to limit them further. But California is the mainstay. I believe North Dakota is another, but California is obviously substantially bigger. California not only has, like, essentially a blanket prohibition on non-compete agreements, the judges have over many decades interpreted that as pretty much ironclad. So nobody even really puts them into their agreements anymore. And when they do, it can actually jeopardize other parts of the agreement. So What I think is important about that is you don't even have to get subjected to the legal system. You know, there's all this stuff about, oh, would you win? I mean, most workers can't just go spend 20, 30 grand or substantially more fighting their employer to go find a job that might pay them, I don't know, $10,000 more a year or whatever it might be, right? So I think what California shows is it's not just that they're prohibited, it's that the whole legal apparatus, like, makes it very clear that the employee will win, and swiftly and cheaply.
Let's go to the lines. Wendy is calling in from Clearwater, Florida. Hi, Wendy. What's your comment?
Hi, Jessica. I just wanted to comment on do not solicit, do not accept, as it applies to, as a physician. They don't necessarily put non-compete clauses anymore, but do not accept. So if a patient chooses to come to me, I can't accept them as a patient if I knew they were my patient previously.
Russell, in the last minute before break, what is a do not accept?
It means that if a customer, or in this case a patient, without being asked by the doctor in this case, to come and continue working with them after the doctor has left the practice, the doctor can't work with them regardless of whether the doctor reached out to them or not.
Even if the patient really wants it?
Even if the patient really wants it.
And that's legal in all of America, or?
No, that varies by state. And physicians actually are in a separate category in a lot of states.
But it's quite common?
It's fairly common, yes.
My gosh, learning a lot today. We're discussing how even sandwich makers and hairstylists are being forced to sign non-competes, and doctors are being forced to sign do not accepts. I'm Jessica Yellen, and this is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interests in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence you need to make an informed decision. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about non-compete clauses in employee contracts. You can join the conversation. Employers, have you turned down prospective employees because of a non-compete? Do these agreements help or hurt your bottom line? I'm talking with Russell Beck, a Boston lawyer who specializes in non-compete and trade secret agreements, Connor Doherty, a technology correspondent in the New York Times, and Princeton economist Alan Krueger. Professor Krueger, would you for a moment talk to us about the larger picture? Because we're constantly talking about the challenges the American worker faces because of globalization, automation, machine work. And it's painted as though all the challenges that confront the American worker are these sort of faceless forces that can't be stopped. But in fact, we're looking at some very concrete steps American employers are taking to hinder employment and wages.
That's right. Some of the problems that American workers are facing are due to external forces, globalization or technological change, automation. And some is a result of corporate policies. Companies who have been outsourcing, for example, so that they can avoid paying higher wages to janitors and other low-paid workers. And non-compete agreements, I think, are part of those corporate policies that have been working to the detriment of workers. What's been taking place over the last 3.5 decades in the U.S. is a tremendous rise in inequality, driven by an increase in wage inequality, a hollowing out of the middle, and stagnant wage growth. And part of that is a result of corporate policies, not faceless economic forces.
The New York Times wrote an editorial suggesting that Congress make non-competes unenforceable when they're applied to employees who earn less than $56,000, which is the median income in 2015. Does that to you seem like a reasonable fix?
To me, I think that's a step in the right direction. I think the default should be that workers who are earning in the bottom half of the income distribution don't have much supervisory responsibilities, are not entrusted with many trade secrets, that the presumption should be that they should face a free labor market without these types of restrictions.
Jody is calling from Cohasset, Massachusetts. Hi, Jody. What's on your mind?
Hi, Jessica. My husband and I are both 64. We have two kids in college. We will both turn 65 this year. I lost my job some months ago, was out of work for 3.5 months, finally found employment. My husband was then let go after 9 years with his company with no severance, no notice, effective immediately, and a non-compete. He received a job offer shortly after being let go, which he could not accept because it's a profoundly unfair and crippling situation. And at the age of nearly 60,
Jody, you know, we're losing your call, but I appreciate you're sharing your story, and we're sorry for your predicament. Russell, she's 65. His husband lost his job, and because of a non-compete, couldn't accept another. Does he have any recourse?
It really depends on the circumstances. If he has no confidential information or trade secrets or customer relationships that the company is entitled to protect, then he should go ahead and just move forward with the job, talk with the old employer and see what the concern is with regard to the new job. And assuming things can work out, which in my experience, well over 90% of them do, he should be able to take that that new job.
So maybe I sound naive, but going to your employer and sort of appealing to them as a human being sometimes really does make a difference.
That's right, because usually these issues usually blow up when a company feels like they've been cheated by the employee or they feel like they've been taken advantage by the employee. It's usually when the employees stick thumb drives into their computers before they leave. That's the things that generally will set off the former employer. But oftentimes, if you go back, if the employee goes back to the company and says, you know, I'm just trying to make a living and I'm not going to do anything that's going to harm the company, usually the company's pretty good about allowing that.
Michael is calling in from Boston. Hi, Michael. What's on your mind?
Hi, Jessica. The subject I wanted to talk about is negotiating non-competes up front. I took a job, an executive job in Boston, and the company presented a two-year non-compete global, very, very broad in terms of companies as they define themselves. I negotiated it. They initially said it couldn't be negotiated. It was VC paperwork. I pushed back. We narrowed it to 6 months. We narrowed it to a small set of competitors and U.S.-centric headquarters. I subsequently left that company, took some consulting work, and joined a competitor about 7 months later. They sued the company because all employees had a two-year non-compete, with the exception of me. And when my company determined that I negotiated it down to 6 months, the issue went away. So my question is, you know, what about negotiating these things up front? What about narrowing the length of time, the scope of companies, the regional scope? Can you do that? When can you do that? It certainly worked out well in my favor.
Thank you, Michael. Russell?
I have found that happens very frequently, in fact, particularly at the higher levels, like the caller. At lower levels, it's a little more difficult. But if the company really wants the employee, oftentimes they will be willing to negotiate and narrow the scope of the restriction or the duration.
Connor, you wrote the article on this. You interviewed a lot of low-skilled workers who signed non-competes. I imagine they had – even if they did have leverage, they wouldn't perceive themselves to be in a position to negotiate. Am I correct?
100%. And on top of that, a lot of people just don't know to negotiate something. I mean, it's like reading your cable bill. You know, you get these employment agreements that are very long. The non-compete is like, you know, Section 7B or something. It's written in impenetrable English. And then you're supposed to know without hiring your own lawyer, I should negotiate this. Plus, one of the bigger things that I'm sure Professor Kruger could talk about is when there's a lot of friction between, a company getting a job, an employee getting a job, that alone just cuts the wages. You know, so how much can an employer really afford to pay you if they're dealing with lawsuits and they're worried about dealing with lawsuits? And how much is it worth it for you to even get a new job if you're worried about, I might have to spend $20,000 hiring a lawyer to, you know, help me out with this situation? Meaning all these things, the kind of difficulty of going over this is its own kind of impediment to wage growth. And the caller who called in before said she's a recruiter. Now, she basically said companies don't want to hire valued employees for their own company because they're scared their competitor will get mad at them. So they hire me, and she's probably paid a nice commission, to do this for them. Well, that money could be going to the employee. There's all this like waste in the middle of the employee and the next job that, even if it's not specific to the non-compete, is still taking money out of what could just be a free labor market.
Go ahead, please.
The technical term is wedges. There are wedges between what the worker is paid, what the company is paying to recruit the worker, and the frictions involved in these transitions. And sometimes the workers are not party at all to these wedges. For example, when a recruiter is paid as a middle person to avoid the appearance of competition with another company. Or here's another example. McDonald's requires its franchisees to, in essence, not compete with each other. They are prohibited by the franchise agreement from hiring a worker who had worked at another McDonald's in the last 6 months. So that's another friction that is artificially imposed on the market, which reduces mobility and restricts pay.
Professor Kruger, can you give us the big picture for a moment? Are American businesses currently paying out an unusually low proportion of their income in the form of wages and salaries?
Absolutely. When I was in graduate school 30 years ago, you know, I was taught that labor's share of national income was a constant, was always around 2/3 of national income. And we've seen that drop to historical lows over the last particularly over the last 20 years. So I think the weakness of labor, as reflected in non-competes, as reflected in the decline in labor unions, has been affecting the share of the pie that's going to workers.
Kevin is calling in from North Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Hi, Kevin. What's your comment?
Hi, Jessica. Thanks for taking my call. I work for Walmart and as a cashier, and I'm a part-time classification, and almost everybody who comes in at the bottom is a part-time classification. Now, we are not allowed to take other part-time jobs with competitors. And in a retail market, which this town happens to be mostly retail, it's impossible to get a second job for the most part. And so, you know, the idea that at the bottom levels that we can rise up with a handicap like that, it's pretty tough.
So, Kevin, you work for the Walmart, but if you wanted to get a part-time job at the hardware store, you're barred from doing that.
Right.
Thank you for the call. Russell, you're our lawyer. What do you say to that? Have you heard of that before?
I can't speak to Walmart's practices, certainly, but that does surprise me. You do hear about these occasionally. I did, in fact, in a lumber store. You mentioned lumber. I had a client a number of years back who had been hired by a lumber company. When he was hired, they took him out to lunch, presented him with a bunch of papers to sign. They asked him to sign them at lunch. He said, well, I've got dyslexia. I'd like to take them home and read them. They said, you don't need to read them. There's nothing in there that you need to worry about. He signed them. And, of course, there was a non-compete in there. Then they didn't pay him what they told him they were going to pay him. And by the time he had come to me, you know, I heard about all these circumstances. He was trying to leave, and he had gotten a nasty letter from another lawyer. I think that was probably the only time in my career that I threatened a lawyer with sanctions if they pursued the case.
Good for you. Rachel is calling from St. Petersburg, Florida. Hi, Rachel. What's your comment?
Hi, Jessica. I'm a hairdresser in St. Petersburg, and my business partner and I left our salon and opened a salon a few miles away, and our boss said that he had wished that we had signed non-competes. And I just want to comment that in our industry, and especially like with salons and spas, it's really hard to think about enforcing non-competes because you're discouraging your employees to, you know, grow and keep that personal touch with clients. So if you were to try to enforce one, it basically says to the client that they're sort of more of a piece of property than they are, you know, a part of, you know, their, you know, hairdresser's book. And so now that I'm on the other side of it, I am choosing not to enforce a non-compete because I know what that would feel like. And I guess I just want to ask, and so hairdressers, if they're listening, are non-competes enforceable in Florida for people who want to leave their salon?
Russell, do you know the answer to that?
I believe they are enforceable in Florida for with regard to hair salon workers. I'm pretty sure. I'm not positive. I know in some states they are, some states they're not.
We're not in the business of giving out legal advice, so we can Google it. But it's I love that she's not enforcing it on other hairdressers. Line three is Bob calling in from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Bob. What's your comment?
Hi, Jessica. I work in the software industry, and in 2009, during the global recession, I was terminated from my job. It turned out I had a non-compete. I had signed it on day one of working there. And it wasn't the company that I was terminated from that was trying to prevent me from working elsewhere, although it was one of those really super vague, you know, agreements that could have applied to anything. It was companies that were interviewing me that would drop me because I had this non-compete. They thought, well, it might apply to us, and we don't want to deal with it, so we can't hire you.
I bet that happens fairly often. Russell, you've seen that.
Yeah, that definitely happens. The companies have to evaluate whether there's a good chance of it being enforced or not.
It's your future employer, not your past one. That's the problem. John is calling in from Boston. Hi, John. What's your comment?
Hi, Jessica. I had been adversely affected by non-competes a couple times in the past, and 3 or 4 years ago had the opportunity to testify in front of a committee of the Massachusetts legislature about non-competes and reforming their enforcement in Massachusetts. I testified along with probably 23 or 24 other people that were in the same boat as me. It was pretty much unanimous. Everybody had been adversely affected. Everybody wanted to see non-competes gotten rid of in Massachusetts. And the whole experience was very inspiring. However, unfortunately, the result was that a few weeks later, the legislation was, they deferred any action on it, tabled it, and kept it in committee. I was able to talk to my local legislator later, who more or less said that although none of the big companies like EMC, which is huge in Massachusetts, testified in open session, they had the ears of the legislators kind of behind closed doors, and kind of their opinion won the day.
Not surprising.
Pretty discouraging.
Big business, big money might not want this to be reformed. Professor Krueger, you are not a political strategist, I know. You are an academic and an economist, but you did spend some time in Washington, D.C., working in the White House. When you were there, what was the appetite in Washington for reforming these kinds of practices?
Well, I think there was and continues to be a lot of concern in Washington about the position of workers, the fact that wage growth has been so weak, especially in this recovery. You hear companies say they can't find enough workers, yet we don't see wages growing as quickly as you might expect, given the shortages they claim that they're facing. And, you know, don't forget, Donald Trump was elected arguing that the economy is rigged against workers. Now, he focused on Wall Street, but here's a really good issue for him to take under his wing and try to do something about. And it's something that the Justice Department can do more about in terms of enforcing antitrust rules when it comes to employer practices.
Connor, I'm going to give you the last word. You saw a lot of people who were harmed by these non-competes. It's time for some reform in Washington.
That would be great.
That's a quick last word. I appreciate it. Okay, Connor, thank you for your piece and your contribution today. Connor Doherty, technology correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks for joining the program.
Thank you.
Russell Beck, partner at the Boston law firm Beck, Reed, Ryden. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Professor Alan Krueger, economist at Princeton University and former economic advisor to President Obama. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jessica.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter or find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.